In the matter of Sun Chemical Corporation versus Spikey Corporation and Suppression Systems Incorporated, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon. For the Kelly Sun Chemical Corporation, Mike Kalin, Jeremy Beer, and Andy Shearer.
Good afternoon, Pino McAlee from Riley McDevitt Hendrick, who is Sue Turpin, also on behalf of Fike and SSI.
Got it, Fike, all right.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I'm the Assistant Superintendent General for the Immediate New Jersey Region.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Chris Placentel on behalf of Amicus New Jersey Association for Justice.
Now, did you introduce yourselves in the order that you wish to be heard, or did it just sort of happen and that's perfectly fine? I'll call you in the order that I have on the list. All right, we'll start with Mr. Kalik, then Mr. Placentella, then Mr. Jesperson, and Mr. McColl. Very good. Please go ahead.
With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
May it please the court, I appear today to address the question certified by this court in response to the petition from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. That question is whether a CFA claim can be based in part or exclusively on a claim that might also be actionable under the PLA. I will first address whether a CFA claim can be based in part on a claim that also might be actionable under the CFA, because under the facts of this case, the vast majority of Sun's losses we submit are not recoverable under the PLA, and thus this part of the question is most important to Sun. I will then address why the vast majority of Sun's damages do not fall within the definition of harm under the PLA, because there's been some question raised about that. Last, I will address the appropriate test for evaluating Sun's relatively modest property damage claim, which from Sun's perspective, from a monetary standpoint, is the least important part of its appeal. To the extent Sun's losses are not redressable by the PLA, Sun should be permitted to pursue them under the CFA. We know, based on this court's precedent, from Dean, from Alloway, and from Spring Motors, that the PLA does not preclude statutory and common and contract claims for economic loss. It should follow, therefore, that a plaintiff's claims for economic loss should not be barred by the PLA simply because a plaintiff suffers other independent and severable damage that fits within the PLA's definition of harm. Despite the broad reach of the PLA, neither its text nor any decision from the court provide a reasoned basis for why a plaintiff that has damages of economic loss should have no remedy simply because it also has damages that fall within the definition of harm. In fact, the language of the PLA and the decisions of this court suggest the opposite, that a plaintiff should be permitted to pursue its purely economic loss damages outside of the PLA. Now, let me start with the language of the PLA itself, because in my experience, the PLA contains an unusual amount of explicit language, both in the Act itself and in its legislative history, that I think goes to this issue. And I think the intent from the Act is to govern only those issues that are directly addressed by the Act and to leave undisturbed all other claims that fall outside of the Act's reach. And this court in Dean went into the Act, into the language of the Act a lot, so I'm not going to go over all of the language that's supportive of this intent. But one quote I think is important from the Act itself: this Act is not intended to codify all issues relating to product liability. That's not the only verbiage in the Act that's supportive of the legislative intent, but it's, I think, one of the most important. And there's at least two quotes that I want to pick out and focus on from the legislative history that I think are important. One is from the Senate Judiciary Statement. It says, "These sections do not, for example, affect existing statutory and common law rules concerning contributory negligence and comparative fault," and this is the important part, "or other matters not expressly addressed by this legislation." I think what the legislature is saying is, if it's governed by the PLA, that's fine. If it's not governed by the PLA, all other common law statutory claims are available. And lastly, there's a lot of legislative history that I think is supportive, but the last thing I want to focus on is the past bill memorandum, which is cited in our reply brief. Quote says, the PLA leaves lawsuits based on damages to the product itself and purely economic damages to the commercial law of contracts. And I think, indeed, this court recognized that the legislative intent of the PLA is to regulate only those issues that fall specifically within the Act.
Counsel, how would that be determined? By motion filed after the pleading or by counsel? And what would be the ramifications if complaint was filed, CFA, for example, in this case, or something else, and it was determined it was PLA? Would there be a saving complaint? Would that be the end of the case? What would the process you envision if your argument is correct?
So I think the very clear line of demarcation is whether your losses qualify as harm under the Act, under A, B, C, or D. And if you have losses that do not qualify as harm under the Act, there is no qualitative analysis that has to take place. Now, if there's a dispute as to whether your losses are derivative of A, B, or C, I think that may be a fact dispute that a trier of fact or the court has to handle. I think in most cases there may not be a dispute on
qualified immunity, pre-trial determination by the court, or would it go to a finder of fact?
I think that issue is probably a factual issue that has to go to a finder of fact. It doesn't seem to be a mixed question of law and fact.
For example, I'm envisioning, say, brake failure. The commercials, the ads say brake, stop your car. So you could argue it's misrepresentation, CFA, because they told you the brakes were going to stop the car and they didn't. But more than likely that would be a products failure claim. So how do you get there with that? Some sophistry in pleading or some sophisticated pleading.
Yeah. So you're really going to sort of a qualitative analysis of whether the claims are more representation-based or product defect-based.
Right.
And that really governs only the products, the property damage part of our claim. My argument is we have economic losses that don't even fit within the definition of harm. You don't have to make that qualitative judgment of whether this is a representation-based claim or whether this is a product defect claim, because we don't have harm as it's defined under the Act.
Is that how you get around Sinclair?
I think Sinclair and also lead paint do not address this specific issue.
So keep them cabined to their factual and procedural settings.
I think that's right. And I think that unfortunately, courts have interpreted those cases broader than they were intended,
mm-hmm.
to say look, if you have something that smells like a products claim, even if it doesn't fit within the Products Liability Act, we're not going to let you bring it because subsumption is so broad. And I don't think that either Sinclair or lead paint stand for that proposition.
Do you accept this doctrine of subsumption when there is overlap between the Consumer Fraud Act and the PLA? So for instance, you're arguing affirmative misrepresentations. Of course, the PLA has failure to warn. There's plenty of overlap there. Is it your position that both causes of action can apply to the same core nucleus of facts?
So, again, the vast majority of our damages I don't think are even harms. So I don't even think you have to get into that qualitative analysis. But for example, if we were going to talk about the $286,000 of property damage and economic loss arising from that property damage, which is all encompassed within that $286,000 that we had, not the millions of dollars of losses we had due to our injured workers, if we're just focused on that $286,000.
Your position is the PLA doesn't cover the injured workers?
It does not cover our losses resulting from the injuries to our workers. Correct.
So I'm understanding. I want you to continue your answer. Your position is if you had filed the product liability claim for failure to warn, you would not be able to claim the injuries caused to your workers and therefore the payments that had to be made as a result of that through workers' comp? Is that
correct? In fact, our injured workers filed a state court action under the Products Liability Act seeking to recover not only their own bodily injury, physical, personal bodily injury under B, their pain and suffering under C, but also their economic losses derived from their pain and suffering and bodily injury under D. They sued Fike in state court.
So your position is the PLA only covers the damage caused to Sun's property, that's it?
Correct. Not our economic losses arising from injury to our workers, and I was gonna address that later in my argument, but that's absolutely our position.
But even if, let's say there was overlap, is it your position that these acts have to be in their separate silos, or whether or not the CFA is able to include damages that might be included within the PLA?
So, and this, I think, argument is relevant to our $286,000 claim, and I do think that there is room. I think trial courts are well equipped to handle a disguised products claim under a misrepresentation theory. But as long as those misrepresentations don't duplicate the claims of manufacturing defect, design defect, or warning defect, as long as they involve other misrepresentations and are not merely dressed up claims, I think there is room to have a CFA claim premised on what is otherwise harmed.
And you do that, you argue, because you have what you're alleging, affirmative misrepresentations.
Correct.
Did Fike defend the state court claims on the workers' compensation bar? Was that the defense, the employees' claims? Did you defend because they belonged in workers' comp as opposed to a...
So these were our employees. These were Sun's employees.
And
so
they sued you. Your employees sued you.
No.
Oh, I thought
they sued Fike.
Oh, okay.
Fike then brought us in on a Laidlaw claim on a third-party claim.
Okay.
We were barred...
I misunderstood. I thought you said they sued you directly.
No. We were barred under the Act, but we did pay workers' comp payments to them. Getting back... to the intent of the Act and why I think if you don't have a PLA claim in the first place, that the Act is relatively clear that you should be allowed to pursue your remedies. I don't think that issue's been squarely addressed by any court, so I think it's fair to say, what should the law be? Prior to the PLA, the common law clearly would have permitted a claimant to pursue its statutory and contract claims based on commercial losses due to misrepresentations. And we, in our initial brief, we try and provide some of that history. As I've mentioned, nothing in the language or the history of the PLA suggests that it was intended to change that, and that it was only focused on unifying various theories for property damage, physical property damage, and personal bodily injury. Unify all those theories into one place. It was not intended to go beyond that. And I think the court should be mindful of this legislative intent.
When you cited to the past bill memo before, there were a few words left at the end of that sentence. I just want you to address them and tell me if you think they're limiting. And it differentiates purely economic damages to the commercial law of contracts under the Uniform Commercial Code. So by that additional language, do you think, and I know it's just a past bill memo written by a staff attorney, do you think that it was limited to that narrow sliver of economic damages, or it can pick up economic damages from other statutory claims like the CFA?
The latter, Your Honor, and I think this court and Dean addressed that, and it said, look, if you're not under, if you don't have harm under the PLA, all the panoply of common law statutory rights should be available to a claimant who's been aggrieved if they can fit within the parameters of those causes of action. Mm-hmm. So while I don't think the PLA from its intent would bar this type of claim, I think at the same time this court has to recognize the broad and remedial purposes of the CFA. And this court has stated in the Lyle Real case and the Lemoletto case that in order to preclude a CFA claim in favor of another regulatory scheme, there must be a sharp and patent conflict between the two, and not the mere possibility of an overlap. And so I think in employing the CFA for its remedial purposes, in looking at the PLA and its limited scope, I think that leaves plenty of room for Sun to pursue its economic losses. And absent express language from the legislature, I don't see any principled reason why the court should interpret the PLA to bar a remedy that is not available under the PLA from being pursued under the CFA. And a simple hypothetical, I think, drives home the point. Let's imagine that when this explosion, this fireball that came back into the plant, didn't damage any property at all. Maybe it was a wide open space, or maybe it was noxious fumes, and there was no property damage at all. So Sun had no harm, and I'll talk about that in a second. Sun had no harm under the act. It would clearly be able to pursue its economic losses outside of the PLA. Why should Sun be in a worse position? And the Attorney General's brief goes into some other examples like this. Why should a plaintiff like Sun be in a worse position simply because it also suffered some harm, divisible harm, under the act? Now, let me move to why we believe that the vast majority of Sun's damages are not harm under the PLA. I'll get into just a couple of facts. I know the court's very familiar with the record. Obviously, there was an explosion the first day of full operations in our plant, and it caused injury to 7 of our employees. 4 of them were seriously injured. The injuries to our employees caused the Chemical Safety Board and OSHA to begin an investigation into the cause of the explosion. The late Senator Lautenberg sent a letter to CSB demanding an investigation.
You know, we have a legal issue. I know you're arguing the facts. We're not going to be deciding the facts. We have one legal issue to decide whether a CFA claim can be based in part or exclusively on a claim that also might be actionable under the PLA.
I want to make it, this argument really goes to why our economic losses do not fall within A, B, C, or D. Because there's been some argument that perhaps our losses are derivative of property damage when they're not. From a factual perspective, they are derivative of our injuries to our workers. And no court that I'm aware of in New Jersey has said that a corporation that has losses due to injury, personal injuries to its customers, for example, or to its employees, is not harm under the act and is pure economic loss. The restatement, however, does address this.
I know, but we're also looking from you for answers to some of the questions. Like one of the questions, whether a CFA claim based now exclusively on a claim that also might be actionable under the PLA, whether or not that's actionable. And your answer to that would be?
Yes.
Yes, okay. as long as it does not duplicate the claim that the remedies that you can get under the PLA. And so that goes back to whether the misrepresentation.
Well, then you're saying in part because the question is whether or not a CFA claim based exclusively on what might also be actionable under the PLA.
Right.
So are you?
So let's take, let's say we didn't have our economic losses. Let's say this case was only about the $286,000.
Right, precisely. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Obviously, this is a position that's less important for my client, but our position is that there is room to bring a CFA claim even for harm under the Act, as long as those alleged misrepresentations under the Consumer Fraud Act do not, in effect, duplicate, just in other words, a failure to warn, a failure to design, or a failure to manufacture properly. And I think trial courts are equipped to evaluate that. So you could have misrepresentations, for example, that do none of those three things. I can give you an example, a sprinkler manufacturer. Let's say that the sprinkler head is defective and you sell it to a homeowner and the sprinkler head sprays the homeowner in the eye and causes injury. That's clearly a products liability claim. They couldn't say, well, you misrepresented to me that this would be safe. When I turned it on, it wouldn't spray me in the eye. There are certain misrepresentations that would just be duplicative of products claims. They couldn't say, for example, that you misrepresented the fact that I shouldn't turn it on when I was too close. You should have warned me of that. That's a warning claim.
Could they say that you misrepresented because it didn't put the fire out like you told us it would? Would that be a CFA claim or still subsumed in the PLA claims as a product failure?
So we have six different...
What if the alarm wasn't loud enough?
Yeah, so the alarm claim is not a failure to warn case. We never allege that they had a duty to warn us of an alarm because there may be lots of uses of this. Well, remember, this was just an add-on to our whole system. There may be a lot of uses for this product that don't require a warning that you're going to have an audible alarm that is loud enough for people to hear. But what our claim is they told us that this alarm was going to be audible, and we relied on it, and that's in part why we purchased the
product. Going back to my earlier question, they told you at the dealership that the brakes would stop your car. That's implicit. That's why you have disc brakes.
Correct.
So is that the brake failed, or is it a misrepresentation claim, as you're suggesting with the alarm? That's why I brought up the alarm.
Yeah, I think the alarm is not like that example, because I think there are some misrepresentations that are dressed up, are just saying that you have a product defect in other language.
Let me clarify something, because maybe I misunderstood. You said that if the remedies were different, then you could have both, as opposed to if the causes of action were different, you could have both. Did you say remedies?
Clearly, if you can't pursue your remedy under the Product Liability Act, we believe that you can pursue it under other...
But won't they always be different? Because Product Liability Act gives you attorney's fees, treble damage. I mean, the CFA gives attorney's fees, treble damages. PLA does not. It limits...
What I'm referring to...
damages. So the remedies will always be different under your analysis. You could always plead both that's your analysis.
What I'm referring to is if you don't have harm as defined by the Act. The Act has very four specific types of harm.
Yeah.
If you do not have that harm under the Act, like most of our damages, you should be able to pursue...
Okay. I misunderstood. I thought you meant that the remedies were different, because the remedies will always be different.
Correct.
Between the two.
No. I mean, if you don't fall within the definitional section of the Act, then you should be free to pursue that. So I just want to convey that because I do think it's in part a legal question of why our economic losses do not fall within B, C, and D.
Can I ask you to try to do that concisely, since we're beyond the allotted 20 minutes you had requested already?
If you take the twin definitions of harm under B and product liability action, it says that product liability action means any claim brought by a claimant for personal physical illness or injury. Taken together, I think that suggests nothing other than to fit within the definition of harm, you have to suffer the injury yourself. And so a corporation cannot pursue, under the Products Liability Act, injuries to others. And as I said before, I think the restatement clearly supports that, gives two examples of it, and the restatement is what this court relied on heavily in the Dean case. Unless there's any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Placitella.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. First, before I start, I just wanted to thank the court on behalf of the bar for the vigilance and you, the steps you've taken to protect the bar and the public in these times. We really appreciate it. On the merits of this case, we believe, I guess I should have gone last, because as amicus, we don't agree with either side. and the reason I say that is we believe that both statutes can be harmonized and pled concurrently. And whether you can ultimately use that statute will depend upon the proofs, after motion practice. But we believe that most of the losses that were sustained in this case are recoverable both under the Product Liability Act and the Consumer Fraud Act. Even the losses, for example, for the injured workers. Every day, subrogation claims are brought pleading the Product Liability Act when employers have to, you know, they stand in the same shoes a lot of times as injured workers. And we believe that the legislature, if you look at the legislative history, a matter of statutory construction, nowhere did the legislature ever say when they enacted the Product Liability Act that they were eliminating any of the remedies or causes of action under the Consumer Fraud Act. In fact, the Consumer Fraud Act was amended 2 times after the Product Liability Act, and the legislature never pulled back at all because the two acts, we say, they're there to address different wrongs and different remedies. The Consumer Fraud Act focuses on the contractual relationship between the parties. The Product Liability Act focuses on the dangers of the product. And the statutory remedies are different. In Dean, this court recognized that there was a legislative intent to differentiate between tort and contract-based remedies. And in Alloway and Dean, the court also made that distinction. So for example, under the Consumer Fraud Act, you could have damages for the cost of the product that went bad, direct harm attributed to that product, and any other ascertainable loss that would be the result of an unconscionable business practice. And the Product Liability Act really focuses on tort-based remedies. So if you look at them both, and you look at the language, because that's really where we have to go, the Consumer Fraud Act and the Product Liability Act, they're not antagonistic. They're complementary and may be applied concurrently in the same case. In enacting the PLA, the legislature's objective was to consolidate common law causes of action focusing on product liability. They never expressed that they wanted to supplant what happened and what the Consumer Fraud Act is meant to address. In fact, there's key language in the Consumer Fraud Act where it makes it pretty clear, we submit, that the Consumer Fraud Act was meant to supplement, not to take the place of, or vice versa. The language actually says in the Act that the Consumer Fraud Act is to be applied in addition to, and here's the key words, and cumulative of any other remedy. So when they say cumulative, from our perspective, what the legislature is saying is you can apply them concurrently in the same case, and the answer to your question would be yes. So when I was wrestling with this, I said, well, what's a practical application of what would happen? So I said, let's say it's a commercial truck driver. And that commercial truck driver purchased a truck. He was an independent trucker. And he purchased that truck for $100,000. And one of the features, the reason he purchased that truck is because it was represented that that truck was reinforced in the back because of prior problems to stop an explosion if there's a rear end hit. And in fact, unfortunately, there is a rear end hit, and it turns out that there was never any reinforcement as promised. And as a result, the equipment inside the truck is damaged, the car next to the truck during the accident is damaged, and the truck driver is damaged. So under that circumstance, where do the damages go? Both acts apply. You can't separate them out. The Consumer Fraud Act would allow for the purchase price of the truck because that's exempted under the Product Liability Act, and it's accordance with this court's holding in Alloway, Dean, and even Spring Motors. The lost income from not having that truck would be
available under the Consumer Fraud Act. The equipment loss inside the truck, we submit, would be available under the Consumer Fraud Act. But under the Product Liability Act, you would have personal injury and all the related damages. You would still probably have the $30,000 or so in equipment, if that's what it was, in the truck.
Are you saying under the CFA, you wouldn't have as consequential damages the injuries to the truck driver?
Under the CFA, I do not believe you would have the injuries to the truck.
Why not, based upon the language you quoted from 2.13, the in addition to and cumulative of any other right, remedy, or prohibition accorded by the statutes of this state, and this ... Why not? Well, why are you stopping it there and not go ahead? Like, why are you stopping it at the injuries? Why is it not complementary there, as you argued earlier?
I'm thinking it through, and it may very well. And these are the issues. That's why I was trying to come up with an example that gives you all the permutations. But since the Product Liability Act meant to really handle personal injury, I just didn't think of it that way. But technically, the way the act is written, you could say that it does in fact apply.
Well, the Product Liability Act also deals with damage to property.
Correct. And I guess that's where I depart from my fellow counsel here, because I believe under D, those derivative claims under the Product Liability Act do cover their damages. That doesn't mean they were wrong for bringing claims under the Consumer Fraud Act. The language, if we just look at the statutes and look what the legislature did, nowhere at any time did the legislature ever take back in any way what they intended the Consumer Fraud Act to cover.
Are you saying they could bring both and recover under both?
Yes, because this is what happens.
So you would get damages for the injuries under the Product Liability Act, under the Consumer Fraud Act, plus the treble damages and the attorney's fees?
Yes, because this is what I think happens, Justice.
Wasn't the whole purpose of the Product Liability Act to limit those type of claims?
Well, the Product Liability Act, they could not collect, under my hypothetical, for the damage to the truck and probably for the lost profits that go directly to the damage of the truck.
But it couldn't recover the damage to the truck twice.
That's correct.
But that has nothing to do with the Product Liability Act.
That's outside the Product Liability Act.
You can't get a windfall.
That's correct. But what happens in every trial is you have a jury verdict sheet, and you answer questions as it relates to liability and damages separately. And the court will, you're not going to get double damages. The court will...
You're going to get treble damages.
You're going to get treble damages. You're not going to get the same damages under both acts, but that's exactly right. So I guess not to go too far over on my time, but that's why I don't believe, and I thought maybe I should go last, and that's why I was sitting in the middle, because I actually believe that neither side has it 100% right. The legislature had 100% right. That's why they enacted two separate cases. This court has always had it 100% right, because in Alloway, Dean, you recognize clearly the distinctions, and you clearly articulated that just because you have a statutory remedy does not mean the Product Liability Act supplants that statutory remedy, especially when the legislature amended the act after the Product Liability Act and never ever said we're pulling back on this set of circumstances.
Could I ask you one question?
Sure.
You're not suggesting you can receive quadruple damages where there's an overlap between the PLA and the CFA?
No, absolutely not.
So I assume that example you were talking about is the jury would have to figure out what's attributable and allowable. The judge would mold the verdict. What's attributable and allowable under the PLA? What's attributable and allowable under the CFA? And then allocate the judgment appropriately.
Absolutely, right? And it's done every day in our trials.
And
every day. That's what the function of the court makes sure it comes out the right way. I even read something what happens with the attorney's fees? How are you going to segregate the attorney's fees? I saw that one of the arguments. Well, the courts do that every day. The lawyers get their timesheets, they give them to the judge, and they say, this is what I spent on this, this is what I spent on that, and the judge looks at it and makes a determination, and that's how they handle it.
What is your position on Sinclair?
I think Sinclair is really limited to its facts. It doesn't apply under these circumstances.
Because there was no PLA claim advanced in this case.
That's correct.
Okay, and that's a differentiating wall that is important.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. So I believe that at the end of the day, permitting the Product Liability Act and the Consumer Fraud Act fulfills the legislative intent here to protect consumers, to promote safe products, and to do exactly what these acts were intended to do. And none of the briefs that I have read have demonstrated, and I wrestled with this, I'm sure like everybody has, because there is some tension in the cases and the phrasing, but if you just go back to basic statutory construction, which is imposed upon us by the law, there's nothing in any of these statutes or the legislative history that would say that one takes away the remedy of the other.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Jesperson.
May it please the court. There are four critical considerations to decide whether or not the PLA subsumes the Consumer Fraud Act. First is this court's decision in Lemolito, which said only if there is a direct, irreconcilable difference between the two statutes is the CFA, the Consumer Fraud Act, supplanted by another statute. The second consideration is the language of the Consumer Fraud Act itself. The Consumer Fraud Act says that this act is cumulative of any other remedy or act that there is. The third consideration is the Products Liability Act does not mention at all the Consumer Fraud Act. The legislative history does not mention the Consumer Fraud Act. So there's no direct guidance in either the legislative history or the language of the Products Liability Act that guides us as to how these two acts are to interrelate. The final consideration is the legislature has dealt with products in the context of the Consumer Fraud Act. Under the Consumer Fraud Act, the legislature has made it a violation of the Consumer Fraud Act to deal in hazardous goods that are used by children. And that amendment happened long after the Products Liability Act was adopted. So the legislature has regulated products, in a sense, under the Consumer Fraud Act. If the legislature intended the Products Liability Act to be the exclusive, or at least exclusive as to the Consumer Fraud Act, regulatory regime for products, it wouldn't have made those amendments. Now, the reason that Lemolito provides guidance is there are three factors under Lemolito that I think are relevant to this case. One is the policy directives or the policy reasons for each of the statutes. The Products Liability Act really has a narrow policy focus. It sought to codify and rationalize one area of tort law, and that is products liability law. It wanted to deal with tort-like conduct and provide a rationalization for tort-like remedies. The Consumer Fraud Act has a different purpose altogether. It is intended to regulate the marketplace. So the Consumer Fraud Act is interested not in the fault of the product, but in the fault of the transaction by which a consumer, whoever that may be, gets the product. So they have different policy reasons, and therefore in the Lemolito, there's no direct conflict there. The second is they deal with different harms. The harms that the Products Liability Act deals with are tort-like harms. And if you look at the language of the statute, that's obvious. It says what you can, the harm, the types of harms you can recover for are personal, physical harms. That sounds pretty much like a tort type of injury or harm. Same thing with harm to goods, physical damage to goods. The Consumer Fraud Act deals with a different type of harm. It's really more of an economic harm. And the language the Consumer Fraud Act uses is if the, and we're dealing now obviously with private litigants, if the private litigant has suffered an ascertainable loss of money or property, that sounds much more like an economic loss than a tort type of loss that falls under the Consumer Fraud Act.
It can overlap very easily. You know, misrepresentation as to a product injures the person. There's an economic loss there. He needs medical coverage for the rest of his life, operations, this, that, and the other thing. And yet that would also be actionable under the PLA, provided that we have a product defect, failure to warn, or whatever.
Yes, that's correct. I think that that's correct. I think that the two causes of action can exist side by side.
And your position is the plaintiff can proceed with one, the other, or both at the same time, as long as there isn't a double recovery on both causes of action.
That's exactly right.
So your position
but
is...
In that, the,
I'm sorry, go ahead. Just go ahead.
But just to clarify your answer to that question, in that overlap for continuing care that's required, what the CFA is covering are medical expenses.
I don't think the CFA would cover medical expenses. And I think
What are you suggesting is covered on an ongoing basis? Is it a more of a tort theory of injury?
Well, I think an example that is helpful is the Lee versus Carter case, which dealt with the Consumer Fraud Act dealing with a product. Under Lee, it was a product that was touted as being able to reduce weight and improve mood, and it didn't do that at all. In fact, I think Justice Albin described the case, described the marketing as a passel full of lies. In that case, the court said, those are consumer fraud losses. That is, the money you spent for the product, the economic damage that you've suffered. Now, let's assume, this was not in Lee versus Carter, but let's assume that that person also suffered some physical injury as a result of ingesting that product. Then they would have a claim under the Products Liability Act. And the tort-like damages that they would have suffered as a result of...
Why wouldn't those be consequential damages? There's an affirmative misrepresentation that these vitamin supplements are going to be fantastic for you. You take them, and then you're poisoned. And as a result of that, now you have medical bills. Aren't those consequential...
Yes,
typical consequential damages from an affirmative misrepresentation?
Yes, that they could be deemed as consequential damages.
And yet they would also be damages under a product liability action as well.
They could be damages under the Product Liability Act, but I think the root of the question is, what do you do to prevent double recovery?
That was my question under the CFA. If we're paying for ongoing medical care or treatments into the future, they're consequential damages more like, I was calling them economic damages, really compensatory damages, unlike the physical injury damages we would see under a PLA claim.
That's correct.
Okay.
Is it your position that PLA subsumes no claim? There's nothing subsumed by PLA?
Our position is that the CFA...
PLA.
The Products Liability Act does not subsume the Consumer Fraud Act. Assuming that the plaintiff can...
Or any other cause of action that involves injury in a product? Common law claims? If it doesn't subsume the CFA, does it subsume common law claims?
It subsumes common law tort claims because that's what the legislators intend. But
not the CFA?
Not the CFA.
Can you derive that from the legislative intent as you read it?
From the legislative intent in the CFA itself. The CFA says this act, the rights and remedies under this act are cumulative of any other act. I didn't say the PLA, but it is another act.
So your answer to the certified question, can a CFA claim be based exclusively on a claim that also might be actionable under the PLA is?
Yes. Your Honor, I'd be more than happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Got it.
Please, court, counsel. In order to address and answer the question that this court has certified, you need to look at three things. The language of the Product Liability Act, the legislative history of the Product Liability Act and the Consumer Fraud Act, and the detrimental effect it would have if you allow concurrence under the CFA and PLA. The Product Liability Act was meant to be the exclusive means of recovery for harm from products, and in passing it, the legislature recognized the need for a statute to establish clear rules in lawsuits involving products. The language, in fact, mandates it apply to any claim or action brought for harm caused by a product, irrespective of the theory underlying the claim, and includes in its definition the harm without limitation for losses deriving from property damage or injury. It's right in there. It states it all. The PLA was enacted in 1987, 30 years after the Consumer Fraud Act. And the legislative history that the council's talked about is important, but it's a little different. The Consumer Fraud Act has been amended over 200 times since it was passed in 1960. And of all those amendments, none of them thought to change or alter in any way the scope of the CFA and say that it should apply anywhere more directly to claims under the PLA. The opposite is not true. The PLA, since its passage in 1987, and despite this court's opinions, et cetera, setting out as an exclusive remedy, subsuming other claims, has never been amended. The legislature has never sought to come together and say, we should change this, not once, year after year, session after session. This court has found in Sinclair, in your own language, that it is the exclusive remedy, and paramount is the word that was used against claims under the CFA. Now, as far as analysis goes, since the PLA is all-encompassing, you have to start there and ask the question, does a claim fall under the PLA at all? In this instance, counsel for Sun argues that, well, we don't fall within the PLA because the vast majority of our damages, we're saying, aren't falling under it. But there's nothing within the wording of the PLA that says Part E, if the majority of damages are not falling within the auspices of property damage that we're looking for, or physical injury or something deriving therefrom, then you're no longer subsumed. That just doesn't exist. What exists is what's set out, and what this court needs to interpret is the actual language of the statute. But that's nowhere in there. And in point of fact, their claim as brought and as represented today includes property damage caused by a product. That's exactly what they brought their case for. This court and a progeny of cases that it's developed has articulated a rule, the essential nature test, essential nature analysis. The other courts have followed, appellate courts have followed, superior courts have followed, the federal courts followed, and they followed in this case. And that says in a case where we have an issue, where we have to look at this situation where there is subsumption or not, we have to look at the core and the heart of the case. I think one court said, what is the dissatisfaction of the plaintiff? And address that in order to determine what is the primary case. Is it a products case or is it a case somewhere else? And that makes sense. Following that in this case, and I know you don't want to get into the facts, but this is a case where allegations were made about a product. And within the complaint, the allegations are, this product doesn't meet these industry standards. But instead of saying a defect, which would make sense as to anybody who's practiced and in this area, and say, it's a defect, we're going to look at it that way, they said, no, that's because you say that and you talk about that being within in your documents, that's actually misrepresentation, not a defect. It doesn't hold water when you're looking at the heart of the claim. Sun contends and continues to contend has no remedy under the PLA, but that's just not correct. That's a strategic distortion. They had a remedy, they didn't pursue it, and they didn't pursue the deriving language, which would have brought all of the other damages under it. There's no case that says they cannot pursue those damages as part of what are deriving from the initial injury. They just decided not to. And this case may be, and again, I don't know, you don't want to know the facts per se because you're not here for that issue, but this case may be an object lesson to this court because there were a lot of things that happened in the production of this facility that Sun would have had to address in a PLA case because of the defenses the legislature gave when it weighed out the defenses and decided what that statute would be. And remember, you've heard a lot about how all counsel want to talk about what the CFA does, but what about what the PLA does? The PLA represents a legislative weighing. The legislature got together and said, we're going to establish an exclusive means of harm for a product, weighing out not only the rights of a victim who's harmed by a product, but also the goods and the manufacturers and sellers and suppliers, big, small, mom and pop, whatever they are, that also have defenses. And it had to be exclusive, and it was laid out that way because, frankly, it needs to be something that you're made to stay in your lane with. And that's the way it's written. That's the way it is set out. If you even look at the language that says that the sponsors and the committee members' own statements should be considered, those statements say this is the sole means of harm from a product because they did that way. That was their function, and they put that language out there, and this court has then interpreted it to mean just that. This is what these cases are about. They're about harm from a product. If you fall within it, you're within it 100%. You can't say a 1%, 10%, 5%, there's no proportionality to it. You don't get to plead your way around it by saying only part of our damages are there and somewhere else we're going to plead the rest of them.
In considering the history of this act, do we stay mindful of the fact that when it was passed, it was regarded as perhaps not the most perfect solution? There was a hope that there would be a national products liability bill, but that was not happening. It's discussed in the history of this bill. New York had just taken some steps in this area, so New Jersey decided it would go forward with some categorization of tort recoveries in the PLA. And when I look at the legislative history, certainly what you say is there, but I also see numerous references to bringing coherence to common law of tort recoveries for theories of products liability. And yet, some language is now being urged upon us by you, and some courts have gone this way as well, that it meant to subsume everything. I'm not sure that fits with the history and intent of this statute if we step back and view it in the context in which it was being adopted.
Well,
how do you respond to that?
I respond to that by saying when you take a step back and you start to look at the subsumption, you look at the detrimental effect to not allow subsumption. And if you do that, you have exactly what you have in this case. It is very easy to plead around the PLA if, as Justice pointed out, you can argue this instance is a case of a failure to warn, or this is really what we're going to call it is a misrepresentation of omission. Certainly that's true. What Your Honor stated is true about when they initially passed the act, but what about each year since then where there's never been a change? And maybe that's the point of this. Is the statutory construction that this court did in Sinclair and the other cases that were done before today recognized not subsuming everything, but subsuming the CFA. It recognized that. There's a line of cases recognizing that. This court that decided this case recognized that and should be given some credence for what they did. But all that happened because of the recognition of how it was set out in the first place. So,
but as you know, sometimes we're asked to take another look at our case law and decide whether or not we still agree that it's exactly right in light of a more full argument.
Absolutely true. And certainly when any court and a lawyer looking at words is going to look at the words for what they mean in their clear meaning. And when you talk about something that says this is a sole means of recovery, sole, exclusive, alone is pretty hard to mix with anything else. The
but
clear
that's
meaning
where we,
of a
that's
word
where we have to come back to the language of the statute, and I think the history of the statute, which seems to be focused on bringing consolidation and understanding to tort recoveries, not all recoveries.
Well, it's true, but whenever you draw a line in a rule, such as this court has articulated, and such as the legislature articulated, in saying, here is a Product Liability Act, and here's what it's going to include, you know, you cannot please all the people all the time, and someone's going to be displeased with that.
Sure.
But it's the legislature who needs to weigh off and say, we need to change this if it needs to be changed. And frankly, that's
yeah,
what could happen.
But
I hear here are arguments from different sides competing to say, hey, change the law for what I would be happy with.
But
I don't hear that the law has been changed.
You're making an argument as though it's clear that the PLA somehow
subsumes the CFA, when if you were to look at the language of the CFA, it would almost suggest the opposite. If you look at 56.8-2.13, we've heard part of it. In addition to and cumulative of any other right, remedy, or prohibition accorded by the statutes of the state. And then it goes on, and nothing contained herein shall be construed to deny, abrogate, or impair any such common law statutory right, remedy, or prohibition. And the legislature said it twice, that these rights and remedies under the CFA are in addition to whatever else there is out there.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Judge Justice Allen, but you're reading from the CFA and not from this PLA. And that's, I think the question here is, we're giving lots of room to the CFA's language without recognizing the exclusivity that's written into the PLA.
Well, where is that? I'm looking at product liability.
Product liability.
Action.
Number one.
Means any claim or action brought by a claimant for harm caused by a product, irrespective of the theory underlying the claim.
And right, and it also says, the legislature further finds that such sponsors or committee statements that may be adopted or included in the history of this act shall be consulted in the interpretation and construction. So the sponsor's statement says it applies to, and I'm reading from the sponsor's statement from the legislative committee, all actions for harm caused by products, except actions caused by harm by breach of an express warranty. That's what they stated there.
By products.
And if you go further, the Senate committee stated all actions for harm caused by products except actions for harm for the breach of an express warranty. But this was the purpose of it, to be all encompassed.
But they're claiming there's a different harm. This is the argument the Attorney General's Act is arguing. The harm here is a marketplace harm, false representations made within the marketplace. And the CFA was intended to combat that, okay, and to deter it. And it uses the most powerful remedies conceivable, treble damages and attorney's fees. So, and they're arguing this, at least this is their argument, was an express misrepresentation, not just a failure to warn. They're claiming that they outright lied to us, basically. Go ahead.
And isn't that the same as any claim where you're going to say we got a product delivered and the product was not what we thought it would be? No. This is the wrestling that's going back and forth. And this court in Sinclair recognized that when the two were together, the language represents a clear legislative intent. Despite the broad reach we give to the CFA, the PLA is paramount when the underlying claim is one for harm caused by
a product. That's
this court.
I think it's possible to make a difference for a failure to warn. Failure to tell me that the thing you just sold me is not going to suppress the explosion. And another thing to be saying to me, I'm telling you, you can take this to the bank. That will never not work. So don't worry about any explosions.
So what I brought up in the beginning is what you do if you allow that is you make it so that almost no one is going to, as a practical matter, pursue a claim under the PLA when it's more advantageous to pursue the CFA. You're going to truncate your claims, and you're going to pursue what would be the easier way of recovery. And remember this, let's be honest.
Why is it easier when the PLA gives some strict liability in many areas?
Because there's no defenses which the legislature put into the Products Liability Act, including comparative defenses where someone misused the product or was using it the wrong way or proceeded in the face of a known danger. So they all exist in the PLA. The CFA is far easier to get to treble damages and attorney fees and to get to any recovery. It's far easier to prove you misrepresented this to me. I don't have to show reliance or I don't have to show that you intended it in any way. All I have to show is there's a misrepresentation. Whereas I don't have to show a defect and deal with all the defenses on this side. So in effect, what you're doing is you're taking property damage cases under the CFA and you're saying, bring them under the CFA. Don't bring them under the PLA because why would you bother?
But that's,
so you're truncating.
We're not doing anything. I mean, then there's an argument that the parties have made.
I apologize.
If you read the statute, that's what the statute says. And if you've got a problem, go to the legislature. That's what your adversaries are saying.
And I'm saying the same thing. If they have a problem with the reach of the PLA, they can certainly go to the legislature to change it. Because that's where the problem comes from. The CFA is very broad. No, I'm sorry, Justice. It's very broad, but that doesn't change what the PLA says.
I thought at the beginning of your argument you said it depends on the essential nature of the claim. I think you're quoting lead paint. That the essential nature of the claim controls PLA or CFA, correct?
The essential nature of the claim.
Essential nature, I think that was used in lead paint.
Correct.
I think so.
So that you would go to the court and there would be a legal determination, I think, and it sounds like what everybody's arguing, there would have to be a legal determination as to whether this sounds, and I think that was what they were trying to get to here, in products liability or consumer fraud, misrepresentation or defect. The court would make that decision. That what's the essential under lead paint, essential underlying nature of the claim, correct?
Exactly.
And so that if they concluded that it was a misrepresentation, we've never had an explosion from this product doing this thing ever before, and it turns out there's five, and whether it was because of a defect that they didn't detect, whatever, they might have a CFA claim, right? On the other hand, if they said, you didn't tell us it blew up because this widget doesn't work properly and was defective, that essentially would be a products liability claim. And the court would make that determination based on the evidence, the depositions, the affidavits, and decide what you can recover under which act. Isn't that kind of what
I think what's happened in this case, and that's what generally happens, except the proviso being that the analysis goes through the Product Liability Act first, not the CFA. Because if you have a product involved, you have to see it. And this is something else that...
How do we know from this record what the essential nature of this claim was?
You have the analysis that was already done of the essential nature of the claim by the district judge who looked at all the evidence. So if you're giving any credence to what was done before and any look to that, that's already been done. That analysis was done with different evidence and all the evidence that was before that judge. So that's an understanding.
So we're not deciding the facts of this case. We're just answering a question. The question
understand.
Is, does the PLA subsume the CFA?
Right.
And can they both coexist depending on a judicial ruling or under legislative history once your product that's in the CFA or vice versa? We're not deciding the facts of your particular case.
I understand that, Your Honor.
In other words, can you... I guess what I'm trying to get at, are you permitted to plead in the alternative? We claim all these things under the CFA, we claim all these things under the PLA, and then the judge or the jury who at some point in time says, yes, we find defective product, yes, we find these damages, and either the judgment is molded, claims are dismissed, I mean, what's the procedural mechanism?
You're absolutely right, and you can plead.
I'm asking you, what is the procedural mechanism?
You can plead in the alternative, and there was no pleading in the alternative in this case, okay. which is surprising, since you had product damage in the property, and you had an explosion that brought on that property damage, and you could have done under both and talked about the deriving language that would have brought them into both, but it just never happened. It was never done. So bringing it under the CFA was their self-determination that they did not want to pursue the PLA or have that decision be made.
The reason why it's not surprising is because they want treble damages and attorney's fees.
I would say that. Your Honor, in conclusion, there's one more point I want to make. Counsel kept getting up on both sides and kept saying these cases fall within Alloway and that line of cases. There is an exception in the Act, in the Product Liability Act, for harm to the product itself. And all of these cases that they're talking about have that. That is not in this case. There is no even mention in this case that's coming before you that there is harm to the product itself. So those cases do not fall within the exception, the exclusion to the PLA's reach at all. It has nothing, they fall without it. Saying the vast majority of damages, and I just wanted to touch on this again, allows an election, and there's no election written into the statute. If what counsel says is true, they can look at their damages and say, hey, we want to pursue this day and this another day. Again, I would say the statutory language, though your Honor pointed out the context in which it's made, still would require the legislature to come and say, we need to rebalance this, as they indicated they were going to a long time ago, but it's still their function. This language is not different language than it was in 2008 when you decided Sinclair. It's not different in how it functions. So there's nothing that really changed there, and if there needed to be a change, certainly the legislature is a place where they can weigh off the balance of those rights of the manufacturers and sellers. They need to do that if they're going to change it. All sides here, there's no one here for them. I'm here for my client, everyone's here for their client, but there's no one here. In the legislature, they could be there to argue those points.
Thank you, Councilman.
Thank you.
Mr. Kalik, brief rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to clarify that the majority of our losses are not harm as defined by the Act. And so the qualitative test of essential nature or whatever test that's going to be used doesn't come into play because we can't pursue those damages under the Products Liability Act. And that's why that question is important to us. And they don't fall within any of A through D because they are economic losses suffered by personal injuries to others or a corporation. I also want to dispel the notion that we brought a disguised claim. We didn't bring a disguised claim here. We had affirmative misrepresentations made to us that induced us to purchase a product that caused us ascertainable loss that we felt millions of dollars of which could not be recoverable under the Products Liability Act because it wasn't harm. We happen to have an incidental amount of property damage that would be harm under the Act. And if under an essential nature test, those damages go away, that's okay with us because we have millions of dollars of damages of economic loss that wouldn't come under the Act in the first place.
I just want to you are at odds with Mr. Placitella with respect to the workers' comp. Because Mr. Placitella was arguing for a subrogation claim under the Product Liability Act for compensation.
Look, I think D has to mean something under the Act. And I view D as being, for example, the lost earnings that you have due to your own personal injury. And so while that is a economic loss in a sense, it's defined under the Act as harm, in my view, and is not pure what Dean and Alloway and Spring Motors call pure economic loss. That's not pure economic loss. That's derivative economic loss to a personal injury to yourself.
Wait, so I
would distinguish those two, situations.
I thought you said that was the subject of a separate claim in state court, presumably by the workers' comp carrier, but in the name of the injured employees, not your claim here. That's not even, you could never come into court here and seek any of those damages ever, correct?
That's your position. Yes, I can only seek those economic losses as outside of tort, only through a contract theory or a fraud theory. That's correct.
In this case, you are seeking damages connected to your employees' injuries and receipt of workers' compensation?
No, so we're seeking the economic losses we suffered because our plant closed.
Okay.
Because of an investigation, because of injuries.
You're not seeking any kind of loss or damage to the employee themselves for their personal injuries as a result of this accident.
There is an element of our claim, Your Honor, that does seek recovery because we were self-insured of the workers'
compensation. Okay.
You're completely self-insured, or
we're
just a retainage? Completely self-insured, or just have a retainage?
I don't know the answer to that question. For the purpose of this case, we were self-insured.
So just to be clear, if the workers brought a product liability action for loss of wages or whatever, and let's say that represented the $1.8 million that you've got that had to be paid to them by you, you want it trebled. You know the $1.8 million that I was paid out? I'm suing you, I want three times that, right? I just want to be clear about that.
That is an element of our damages.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel.